because he now felt the same thrilling, pleasurable terror in front of these urfers as he had in front of real girls at that age. Adolescent triggers aside, he sensed a graceful beauty in this Meg that he figured would probably transcend any species line. Her teeth unnerved him. Their translucent paleness seemed even more fragile than the long, tapered fingers and her incredibly flexible neck. The way her head snapped around to ring out a warning to her people made his stomach clench in imagined pain. When those long arms unfolded themselves and the fingers fluttered so quickly he could hardly follow, he just knew she had noticed the weapons carousels moving into place. He didn't know why she had singled him out to try to make contact. Maybe his accidental flinging of the microphone cover had acted as some sort of greeting on their planet. Maybe they could read minds and sensed he meant them no harm. Whatever the reason, Lul felt they had forged a bond, and he would be damned if he'd let even a ranking trio of generals rob him of this moment. So he'd shouted at them to stand down, and they did. And when everything had gotten quiet, Lul had taken the chance of introducing himself to the first alien race to ever step foot on Didet. The Urfers were definitely reacting even with the lowering of the palm cannons. All but Meg stepped backward in that bizarre slow high step that he'd thought was their only means of locomotion. Meg had sure proven that wrong by leaping like a flickerbug when he'd addressed the leader. He wondered for a moment if maybe he'd offended her by stepping up to speak to the leader of the Chevron instead of staying by her. But when she'd dropped to the ground, and she sure could move quickly, he just knew she wanted to show him something. Maybe they really were mind-reading. Or maybe the sight of another of those cool light screens appearing out of nowhere and lighting up on the ground with strange symbols and images was more than he could possibly hope to resist. The way she had stared into his eyes, her strange wide mouth and glass-like teeth shining when he stared back at her, made him hope she could read his mind. Every fiber in his being wanted to scream, we're friends, take me into space. He couldn't shake the stupid kinder school thrill of being in the coolest place in the world and for once being the center of attention. And she had stared and stared, her liquid eyes so expressive even while bewildering him. Then all that pointing, all those stabbing gestures to that amazing screen, and it had dawned on him like the red sun. Yes and no. She wanted to learn how to say yes and no in Didero. Well, Kartara, technically, since there were plenty of languages on Didet that said it differently. For the millionth time since he'd seen the ship on the Roana slab, Lul said a silent thanks that he'd found himself at this very spot. Now the generals waited for a cue from him. The Urfers lined up in front of their ship, the crew member on the other side of the leader withdrawing some strange cylindrical package. It could be a weapon. He knew the generals were certainly thinking that, and if it turned out they were right, Lul hoped the aliens would have the decency to shoot him first and spare him the disgrace of his misplaced trust. Instead, the cylinder opened up into a large bubble made of what looked like a slippery reflective film. At first glance, Lul thought it was made of liquid, but the bubble form held its shape as the Urfer secured it to the ground with small white pegs. "Pell!" Ada shouted at him, but his tone sounded more cautious than angry.
"What is that? Can you see it? Can you see what that is?"
Lul glanced at Meg, although he knew she couldn't give him any explanation. Then another bubble popped up and got attached to the ground. One of the Urfers, the smallest of the team, who was as pale as Meg, so he decided it was a female too, kept its eyes on the soldiers while the others scrabbled their fingers over the front of each bubble, creating a gap in the reflective film. Moving slowly and occasionally turning their heads in that bizarre bendy way to see over their shoulders, they reached into the bubbles and laid something out on the ground inside. He looked to Meg, who watched him watch them. How could he ask her what they were doing? Yes and no had felt like an incredible breakthrough, but now these Urfers, these aliens, were getting busy doing something that made the enormous battalion of armed guards behind him nervous. Everyone, himself included, counted on him to figure out the explanation. He was going to have to get down to basics. He pointed to the strange bubbles and pushed his chin down into his neck. He knew the gesture made him look like an infant, but everyone knew the universal gesture for confusion, right? Meg watched him as he repeated the sequence, her own head tilting strangely to the side as if the slender neck could no longer hold the weight of her long skull. Then she straightened, and he thought he recognized in the widening of her eyes the same expression he'd seen when they'd solved the yes-no confusion. She pointed at the horizon over the Keter Sea, where the wind whipped sand and dust into a frenzy in the lowering light of the red sun. He followed where she pointed, and when he looked back at her, she flattened her long hands out, palms facing out and slightly overlapping, and held them to the side of her face, her eyes tightly closed. She stayed that way a moment, then opened her eyes once more, the question clear in her expression. She repeated the gesture again. Lul thought she could probably repeat it 1,000 times and he wouldn't get it. Were the bubbles somehow related to the Keter Sea? What would that have to do with their faces? Was the gesture some sort of warning? A greeting? It could mean anything, and Lul knew the generals wouldn't wait forever. Meg's head shivered in a strange back-and-forth way that made him marvel again at the willowy structure of her body. Her eyes glanced around him, and when she looked back at him, he saw a settling in her stance that he understood. She was going to try to explain again. She pointed to his right, to the Keter Sea, where the red sun nearly touched the roiling water. When his gaze returned to her, she then pointed behind him and up to his left where the archive cameras gathered high on metal poles, their shade screens blocking out most of the pale light of the Fa Sun behind them. Then she pointed behind her right shoulder to the media webbing that rose high enough to block out terrestrial media and scramble most satellite receivers. The rising Eliban sun had just started to color the white webbing a rich shade of orange. When she turned back to Lul, Meg bent her slender neck, her head dropping forward as her long, thin arms came up and wrapped around her skull. She sat that way a long moment, her head almost totally hidden within her arms, before looking up at him again. The Keter Sea, the archive cameras, and the media webbing had something to do with the reflective bubbles and the strange arm-head gesture. His first thought when she'd brought her arms up was that she was hiding, coiling up the way a sand snake did when a predator came near. Was she afraid? Was she injured? He brought his hands up and pulled his knuckles apart, saying the word with the gesture.
No.
She flattened her hands once more, the way she had the first time, and faced her overlapping palms again toward the Keter Sea. Then she pointed them toward the archive cameras, and then, twisting around, toward the media webbing. Each time she made a point to keep her face behind the thin, splayed fingers. When he dropped his knuckles once more, she turned to the Urfers and chimed out a soft, high sound. One of her crew, Lul thought it might be the Urfer who had stood beside her, chirped something back and made a strange lifting motion with its shoulders. Then, turning its back on the crowd, it dropped into a crouch and clambered inside the bubble. A moment later, it stuck its head out of the opening and showed its palm to Meg and Lul with a back-and-forth motion. Once more, Meg pointed to the sea, the cameras, and the webbing, and waited for Lul to put it together. Was he just dense? Did anyone else on the other side of the barricade see what she was doing and understand it? He ground his teeth together in frustration and looked again in the directions she had pointed to. The Keter Sea, the archive cameras on their posts, the high media webbing. Why not to the sky behind the shuttle where the scrub brush still smoked from whatever sort of fuel the ship had burned landing? Why not directly behind the generals where another wall of media webbing rose high and white? Color? He looked again. The red sun made everything in that direction red, and the webbing behind her glowed more orange by the minute as Eliban rose. But the archive cameras didn't match. The shadows grew around them as the light changed. But for the most part, the screen stayed the same dull gray as always. They were hardly even needed since the cameras had been positioned in such a way that all they had to block out was the faint light of the Fa Sun. And then he got it. He banged his knuckles together, grinning as he saw Meg's teeth come back into view. He knew she knew he got it, and once more they bumped the outsides of their hands together. Lul turned as much as he could to speak to the generals without losing sight of Meg. Not that he feared turning his back on her. He just didn't think he'd ever get enough of watching those wet eyes widen for him.
General Ada? I think those are shelters. I think there's some sort of protective film. It's the Suns. They don't like the Suns.
What do you mean they don't like the Suns? What are they doing here, then? What's inside those bubbles?
I think they will be.
Lul watched the Urfers set up two more bubbles.
I think they stay inside them.
Why? The voice sounded gravelly and feminine, so he assumed General Fama spoke.
I don't know. Their skin is different. It's really smooth and shiny, and their eyes are wet. I wonder if the Suns are too hot on them, or maybe interfere with their body chemistry.
He'd run these and other possible scenarios years ago in his ill-fated report on an alien invasion.
Well, tell them they can get in their bubbles back at the military research station just as soon as we get them loaded into the trucks.
Lul huffed in frustration. It had taken him forever to figure out how to say yes and no, and he was still only guessing about the bubbles. Now Ada thought he could casually explain that the military planned on moving them?
I'm not sure I'll be able to explain that, General.
You'd better start trying, Pell. We can't keep this webbing up forever. The reporters are already getting nosy about why the site is shut down. We've got to get these things into lockdown before we start a worldwide panic.
Lul ground his teeth. How was he supposed to pull this off?
Keep it simple,
he muttered to himself and saw Meg's head tilt again at the sound. Her eyes fixed on his mouth and he knew she'd heard him. Sharp hearing, he thought. Good to keep in mind. He brought his hands together between them, trying to mimic the settling stance he'd seen her take before, what he was coming to think of as the start-over position. Meg seemed to recognize it because she mirrored him immediately.
Urfers.
He waved his hands over her crew. She tapped her knuckles together.
Trucks.
He waved his hand over the line of cargo trucks lined up to the left of the archive cameras. Feeling a little bit stupid, he swung his hands like a monkey from the alien crew to the trucks.
Urfers. Trucks. Go.
Meg tilted her head again, narrowing her eyes. Something told him that was her equivalent of the chin-dip confusion pose. So much for universal gestures. He repeated the motions again.
Urfers. Trucks. Go.
He didn't know how she'd react to his grip, so he let his arm sort of hover in the area near her side, rocking on his feet toward the trucks.
Urfers. Trucks. Go.
He saw the moment she understood. She made a wide, sweeping gesture that held 1,000 times more grace than his had, her sweep encompassing her crew before whipping like a palm frond toward the trucks. She even turned her body toward the trucks and took a small step in that direction. He grinned, knocking his knuckles together.
Yes.
She held her hands before his face and let the knuckles drop. No. Maybe she had misunderstood, so he repeated himself, rocking toward the trucks as he had before, starting a small step as she had.
Urfers, trucks, go. Yes.
Again her knuckles fell away. No. Urfers. He could just make out the high, breathy tone of her voice, but he clearly understood the strong stabbing motion she made with both hands toward the ground. He looked up into her eyes, noticing that in her refusal she had pulled her body up to its full, narrow height. He sighed, feeling tension building in his throat as he turned.
General Ada, I don't think they're going to go.
He ignored the rumble of disapproval as a familiar feeling washed over him.
Oh, and General, you're going to want to send someone out here. I've got a drop.
Meg. Get ready for some more synchronized swimming, everyone. Meg backed away from Lul while he shouted to the officers at the barricade. They want to move us into those trucks.
Why?
Jefferson asked, standing up from where he'd been fastening a shelter tent.
Are they planning to take us to some top-secret medical lab and dissect us?
Cho didn't pretend to see any humor in that.
That's what we would do.
Yeah, Meg said, backing up several steps, keeping her eyes on Lul. I think it's safe to say that leaving the ship is a very bad idea until we have a much stronger language bond.
What do you recommend, Meg?
Wagner asked. Go back to standing absolutely still. Look how they fidget. She scanned the crowd before her. They never really stop moving, adjusting.
I'd wager it's their musculature,
Cho said.
Their build is incredibly dense. The muscles on their legs alone could probably take a bullet. I don't think they're fast, but my money's on them being strong.
I'm with you. Meg stopped retreating and now stood halfway between Lul and Cho. She wished she'd thought to get out of her suit at some point before now. The heat pouring in from the direction of the sea baked her skin, even with the steady, salty wind pounding against her. She noticed with envy that Cho had shed his suit well inside his tent. She heard his low laugh in the comms.
You're wishing you had that suit off, aren't you?
Stop reading my mind.
Get over here.
When Meg didn't move, he sighed.
I'm the chief bioscience officer, and I'm telling you to get your ass over here and get out of that suit.
Prater snickered.
That's a new one. Why don't you two get a room?
Well, unless any of you packed IV fluid bags in your packs, I suggest you all get out of your suits.
Cho knelt at the edge of his tent.
This sunlight is going to drain us. Keep your sleeves rolled down and put on a hat, but these suits are going to overheat us all. Meg, keep your eyes on your boy and back up toward me. I'll get you out of yours.
She did as he told her, backing up until she felt his hands on her shoulder. The suit had two release clips, one inside beside her left ribs, and one just inside the rigid rim of the collar ring. Either one would release the magnetic zippers that ensured the suit remained sealed. She felt Cho's warm, dry fingers against her sweaty neck as he deactivated the fastener. A puff of stale air blew out from the suit as the fabric separated down the length of her spine.
I bet I smell good, she laughed, knowing how sweaty she was.
His hands slid around her waist, doing more than was strictly necessary to help her step from the suit.
You smell okay.
When her right leg and arm were free, he helped her pull the rigid collar over her head, shucking the rest of the suit. As Cho slipped her gun from the suit pocket to her pants, she pulled down the sleeves of her lightweight regulation shirt, feeling the specially designed fabric wicking moisture from her damp skin. When she sighed at the relief, she heard Prater and Jefferson laugh and speak in unison.
Get a room. Look at me.
Cho ignored them and turned her to face him. She tilted her head, lifting the back of her thick brown ponytail to get a breeze on the damp curls beneath. Cho leaned in close and shocked her by kissing her right on the mouth.
Did you feel that?
She stepped back, staring at him. It wasn't that he'd kissed her. He'd done plenty of that and more. But this hardly seemed the time.
Did you feel that?
His voice was soft and low.
This is... Cho?
He smirked.
My mouth tastes like glue. So does yours. We're all getting dehydrated and we don't have a lot of water. Why don't you make your next conversation with your new boyfriend about finding us some supplies?
She rolled her eyes as she turned around.
You could have just asked, you know.
Uh-oh.
She and Cho spoke in unison. A section of the barricade had separated, and two Didetto approached, pushing a squat wheeled cart between them. The cart came to their shoulders, and the uneven terrain didn't make the movement any easier. They moved steadily, their eyes fixed on Meg and Cho, dropping only to navigate a bump or divot. Lul called her name. She pointed to the trucks and pulled her knuckles apart. No. Lul did the same.
What do you suppose this is?
She said to Cho as much as to herself.
They're opening it.
Cho stepped in closer to her, pressing up behind her shoulder. They watched as the two newcomers punched into the top corners of the carton, releasing some sort of catch. The sides of the carton dropped slowly on pulleys, revealing racks filled with metal containers. The figures, women presumably, judging by what looked like heavy breasts riding low on their torsos, crouched down beside the carton and began selecting containers. Beside them, Lul crouched, watching them and talking to them in low, rumbling tones. Meg heard Cho's breath catch.
Let's go closer.
Cho, she said, but he stepped ahead of her and she hurried to keep step. Slow down, Cho. We don't want to seem aggressive. What are you doing?
I'm thinking what we would do if the situations were reversed.
They heard Prater snort in the comms.
If the situation was reversed, we'd have blown these fuckers out of the sky before they hit atmosphere.
Thanks for the encouragement, Prater, you psychopath.
Cho stopped a yard away from the open carton and its handlers. He crouched down for a better look, and Meg could hear the pitch of the Didetto thrumming rise.
We're a new life form to them. We haven't hurt anyone. We don't have laser beams coming out of our eyes, so now they're trying to figure out who or what we are. And how do you do that?
He smiled to himself.
You send in scientists.
One of the women took a damp cloth from a jar and handed it to Lul. After a brief exchange, Lul began wiping his hands with the cloth thoroughly, getting in between fingers and scrubbing especially hard on the outsides of his palms. Another word from the woman and he dropped the cloth into another container, which the woman promptly sealed.
They're testing him for contamination, Cho said softly. They saw you two touch and they're assessing any threat level. Maybe they're going to run a DNA sequence.
Are we a threat? Meg asked. Didn't you test for microbes and contaminants before we opened the hatch? Isn't that part of the initial probe?
Shit, Jefferson hissed in her ear. It's a little late to be worrying about that, isn't it? I found nothing that would contaminate us. It doesn't mean I found everything, or that we won't contaminate them.
Oh my God, Meg said. Did we just bring smallpox to the new world?
Hey, have a little faith in your science officer, okay? In the first place, Bess expunged our systems of most lingering parasites and viruses. Second, why do you think our protein tasted especially bad the past few days? Purifiers. We're as clean as we're going to get, and we have no choice but to take our chances.
He huffed out a breath.
We're agents of change and evolution just by being alive. Deal with it.
The scientists turned to face Meg and Cho as Lul held out his hands for them to see them. He's showing us he's fine, Meg said. He wants us to come to them.
Hang on,
Cho whispered, rising from his crouch and shuffling backward toward his tent. All Didetto eyes followed him, and he returned a moment later with a small metal case. Jefferson snickered.
Hers is bigger than yours.
Prater laughed, too.
He's used to hearing that.
Captain Wagner's voice was all business.
I'm glad to see this momentous occasion in human history isn't interfering with your need to be ass clowns. Let's cut the chatter.
A round of yes sirs came through, although Meg could hear Prater swallowing the words ass clowns and a laugh. Cho seemed to hear none of it, focusing on opening his testing case and pulling out a drag screen of his own. Once things were set up to his liking, he pulled on latex gloves.
Are those supposed to make me feel confident?
Meg's eyes had widened along with Lul's, but the scientists seemed to take the action in stride. One did lean in closer to watch as Cho slipped the stretchy material over his hands.
Our hands must look strange to them,
he said, holding up a gloved palm for the woman on the left to see more clearly.
Their hands are so blunt compared to ours. I guess they didn't evolve from an arboreal species. I'm running a scan of the known wildlife to see if I can narrow down what their ancestry might be.
Meg recognized that breathy monotone he spoke in. She could almost hear the wheels spinning in his head as he took in the reality of standing so close to these people. She leaned into him enough to brush his shoulder.
Not thinking about water now, are you?
Shut up.
He didn't look at her, but she could see the corner of his mouth resisting a smile.
Here we go.
One of the scientists held out a wet blue cloth. Cho reached out and took it from her with one gloved hand while reaching into his kit with another. He drew out a small tool that looked like a combination clamp and flashlight. He held the cloth between the prongs of the tool and waited as light shone over the fabric. A ding sounded from his drag screen, and Cho nodded as he read the scrolling data. He handed the cloth to Meg.
Me? I have to touch it? Do I need gloves?
Gloves would sort of defeat the purpose. You touched him. They want to know what you're made of. They can compare the samples off of his hands.
She saw Lul tap his knuckles together, rocking a bit in his crouch as if encouraging her. She took a deep breath and rubbed the damp cloth over her hands.
Ooh, it's cool. Feels kind of good. I wouldn't mind swabbing down my neck with this.
It's a neutral mineral-based fluid. Seems non-reactive. Probably a testing solution.
Probably? Meg asked, holding the cloth out with two fingers. Cho shrugged.
Of course, it could be a unique solution that reacts with your skin chemistry to transform into liquid nitrogen and freeze your fingers off. How cold is it?
Meg saw that smirk again.
Bioscience humor. Hilarious. Do you need this cloth, or can I give it back to her?
Cho snipped off a corner of the fabric and caught it in a plastic vial. Again, the scientist didn't react. The one on the right just held out a jar, and Meg dropped the cloth inside. Cho held up the lighted tool for the women to see. He placed his finger between the glowing prongs and held it there for several seconds. Then he held up the scanned finger for them to see. A few grumbled words exchanged, and the scientist on the left held out her finger.
Huh, Meg said. Maybe you don't need a translator.
She saw the smug arch of his brow as he shifted to reach the outstretched finger.
Science. The universal language. Shit.
The woman's thick finger didn't fit between the prongs, and Cho hurried to find a different scanner. Meg laughed under her breath.
Hers really is bigger than yours.
Cho scanned the back of the Daidado scientist's hand with a wand-like scanner.
I believe the words ass clown have already been used today, if I'm not.
His words trailed off as the woman turned her hand over and extended her fingers.
Would you look at that?
The woman held her open palm up for them to see. Fully extended, the fingers were shorter than any of the Earther's hands, and the same rough sand-colored skin on the back of the hands covered most of the palms. But where they expected to see the same folds and creases they knew in the bends of their own hands, the Daidado's skin separated, revealing tender swaths of smooth pink skin. Across the palms, in the crooks of the knuckles, and tapering up into the pads of the fingertips, the pale pink skin flexed and pulsed where the darker skin pulled away.
Is it a scar? Meg asked.
I don't think so.
Cho spoke softly, his voice filled with awe.
I think it's, I don't know, maybe how they feel?
He peeled off his latex glove and held his palm out toward the women. In unison, they dipped their chins, leaning forward for a closer look at Cho's unbroken skin.
I should really use the scanner first, check for surface tissue.
Meg held her breath as his words faded and his hand moved forward until his longer, narrower hand touched the broad pink and brown palm before him. She knew the moment they touched. She could hear it in Cho's breathing and in the dropping pitch of the woman's throat. They held their pose for several shallow breaths, and Meg could see the effort it took Cho to withdraw his hand. Even just as a bystander, she felt that same everything-falling-away sensation she'd felt when she'd looked into Lul's eyes up close. They were scientists, explorers, billions of miles from home on a controversial one-way mission to rewrite human history. They had mind-melting amounts of data to gather and process, tests to perform and analyses to make, But all of that seemed to fall away when they could see and hear and smell the presence of these wondrous creatures in front of them. Cho took a deep breath and focused on scanning the woman's hand. Meg had seen him use these before. The wand was a simple bio-identifier used for everything from security to wildlife tagging. She knew he had a much more complex scanner he wanted to use, but even with the rapport they all seemed to feel, the full-body scanner would probably require a little explanation, and that would require some language. She doubted even a scientist would willingly step into a glowing square of light that popped up out of nowhere. As Cho set his data programming in motion, the scientists picked through the jars in their cart. They spoke in low, guttural tones to each other, and their motions suggested they worked together often. Meg had to laugh. Even with the marked differences between the Didetto and the Earthers, something in their expressions reminded her of the serious, distracted scowl Cho wore whenever he lost himself in his work. She glanced at Lul, assuming he'd been as enwrapped in the encounter as she'd been, but he sat deep in his crouch, his eyes closed and his head settled down low into his neck in a strange turtle-like way. No humming sounded from his throat. Lul? She moved to him quickly. He sat too still, no muscles fidgeting at all. Lul? She reached out to touch him, fear souring her mouth when he still didn't move. Before she could reach him, the scientist closer to him barked out a sharp sound, making her stop. The scientist pulled her knuckles apart. No. But Lul? Meg pointed, knowing they couldn't understand her. Is he okay? The women grunted to each other in rapid exchange, and while Meg felt confident she could move faster than either of them, she sensed they would do what they could to keep her from reaching Lul. Cho put his hand on her arm to pull her back. Cho, what's happening? What's wrong with Lul? He's not moving.
Well, they don't seem very worried about it, so that's in our favor.
His voice didn't match the optimism of his words.
How do I ask them a question?
Meg settled back into a neutral stance and could see the women relax. She pointed to Lul and mimicked his position as best she could, closing her eyes for just a moment before looking back to them and holding out her hands in surrender. The women shared a few more grumbling words. The one on the right, closest to Lul, pointed to the still man and then scrunched her head down between her shoulders in the same strange way as Lul's. She closed her eyes for a moment and then opened them, tapping her knuckles together. Yes. She repeated the sequence, scrunch, close, open, yes, and looked at Meg and Cho, waiting for them to understand. Cho shifted beside her.
Is he asleep?
Meg made a sound of disbelief. Here? In 2 minutes in the middle of a field? In a catcher's crouch with all this noise and these people? With us here? Before Cho could answer, Lul's eyes popped open and he blinked several times. When he saw Meg so close, he smiled. Then he yawned. Chapter 6 Meg. Huh. She and Cho spoke in unison as Lul shook off his strange stillness. His eyes widened as he smiled at Meg and said something to the scientists. Everything in his body language suggested that nothing out of the ordinary had taken place. Judging from the punchy gestures the scientists were peppering their words with, they had a different story to tell. The scientist in the middle kept jabbing a stubby finger in Meg's direction.
I don't think they're happy with you,
Cho said, following the guttural exchange. Well, I'm sorry if I think that turning to stone in the middle of first contact is a little unusual. She watched Lul as he shifted in his crouch, inching closer to her.
Meg.
He pressed his knuckles together, barking out her name loud enough to make her wince.
Lul.
He tapped his own chest and made the yes gesture 2 more times, alternating hand bumps with quick dips into the odd still position that had so unsettled her. Each time he reopened his eyes, he made the yes gesture again, repeating a low popping sound. The third time he started the series, Meg activated the recording program and opened a text screen. Lule hesitated, watching her fingers scrabble over the lighted screen, and then resumed the sequence. Cho watched her arrange the data on her screen.
Did you just get something?
Okay.
Okay, what?
Let's see if this is right. She tapped the screen before her, activating the audio command function. Looking up at the Didetto before her, she spoke in clear, clipped tones. Lule is okay. After a pause, her speaker patch emitted the recorded sounds of Lule's voice. She could hear the gaps where the computer had pieced together the sounds, but it created the desired effect. Lule and the scientist's eyes widened enough that Meg could see white around their gray irises, and all three mouths fell open. The women remained frozen, but Lule dropped forward on his fists. His mouth opened in a wide grin as he leaned in close. As he spoke, she heard her own voice in her translation comm pieced together by the program. Yes. Okay, is Lule. Yes. She didn't realize she was leaning forward, too, their faces less than a foot from each other. She grinned at his grin. How about that? She whispered to herself, and then quieted, listening for the familiar ping of the program organizing the next set of sounds he made. Meg is yes, okay, is yes. Cho frowned at the screen.
What does that mean? Did you just say that?
Shh. She didn't want to interrupt the audio capture to explain the process to Cho. In time, the program would change the translation voice to a gender-neutral generated voice, but for now she had it programmed to translate into her own voice, making it easier for her to add vocabulary as she came across it. In the comms, she knew it must sound strange to the rest of the crew, like she was babbling to herself, but she couldn't worry about that now. Instead, she dipped forward slightly, urging Lule to repeat himself. Meg is yes. Okay is yes. She grinned again as comprehension dawned. Oh, there you are. Oh, you beautiful, beautiful thing. A few swipes on the screen and Cho saw the text boxes double. Her speaker patch emitted more guttural sounds as she spoke into the translation comm. Yes, Meg is okay. Cho watched as she and Lule bumped hands again, she giggling, he rumbling low in his throat.
Do I even want to ask what just happened?
Meg laughed louder. Funny you say that. I just found the interrogative structure. Cho snorted.
Is that like porn for language nerds?
As a matter of fact, it is. Meg arranged the text boxes on the screen, moving her hands so that Lule could watch. It would be a while before he'd be able to operate a screen of his own, but she could tell he was putting together the function of the program. All the Earthers would have a similar screen to Meg's, each customized to their particular programs and all with access to the full data bank. Meg arranged the screens intuitively, organizing text vocal patterns in what she felt was an organic pattern. The layout wasn't dissimilar to the old Ouija board she and her sister Maddie used to play with when they were kids. Yes and no held prominent spots at the top corners of the screen. Now that the program had recognized OK as similar to yes, she grouped the sounds nearby. It had worked for the translations of the last isolated tribe she'd been called in to work with. It had worked with the seemingly impenetrable pidgin language of the Outer Worthery colonies. Affirmatives and negatives could usually be grouped together. Yes, okay, good, versus no, not okay, bad. To be able to signify the interrogative, whether by tone, word, or symbol, meant actual conversation could take place. It would be rudimentary at first. Hold something up. Interrogative. Yes or no. Good or bad. From there, the general question base could grow quickly. Who, what, where, how, and the hardest of them all, when. Objects were the easiest to classify. The main database already held hundreds of thousands of images that could be labeled in Didetto by any member of the crew. With a little luck, Wagner might even find a way to interface with whatever passed for a computer system on this planet. He had even asked her about that long before the mission parameters had been set. He and Prater had argued that if a civilization used any type of mathematics and/or a binary system for their communication devices, the language gap could be bridged. To them, numbers were a universal constant exceeding the limitations of language. After all, a great deal of the ancient message that had incited this entire expedition had been mathematically based. But after the numbers had stopped rolling in and the coordinates and engineering aspects had been calculated, there had remained within the transmission a message that would not compute as numerical language. That was when Meg had been called in. That's when the argument for language and protocol had begun, and that was when Meg had truly believed she would finally be leaving Earth for good. She'd had to fight hard for respect from Wagner and others on the mission committee who still didn't completely understand what purpose she served. Like so many people, the word protocol evoked thoughts of properly folded napkins, diplomatic niceties, and the fine-tuned formalities of political maneuvering. Cho had backed her authority and not, as some had suggested, simply because they had become lovers on the last mission to the Worthery colonies. He had seen her in action. Plague had broken out on an isolated moon, and all attempts at contact had been met with aggression. As a bioscientist, Cho wanted to be on the ground, to see firsthand what had gone wrong in the terraforming chain to create such a deadly pestilence. He and more than 24 other aid workers had hovered in the atmosphere listening as Meg, accompanied by only one armed guard, shuttled to the planet's surface, met with the military leader, and created a language and protocol bond that finally allowed her to reassure the president that the aid workers' intentions were honorable. Thousands of lives had been saved on that mission, and research into the genetic malfunction had broken new ground. The rescue workers and medical staff had been hailed as heroes, but every one of them had attested before the International Space Commission on the finesse of her diplomacy. They had all seen and heard the delicate give and take, the patience and instinct Meg had brought to the incendiary situation. During a break in the aid campaign, after the worst of the crisis had abated, she and Cho had lain together in a shuttle bunk too small for two people. Both exhausted, they had been able to do little more than rest against each other in pale blue night shift lights. Cho had been working around the clock stabilizing inoculations. Meg had spent 6 tense hours smoothing over an unintentional affront to the president's mother that had led to a lot of guns being pointed and a lot of people all at once. She in the middle trying to remember the symbolic hand gestures of mediation she'd been absorbing like oxygen since arriving. Her nerves were frayed to the point of physical pain, and when Cho slid a warm, calloused hand up her spine, she nearly wept.
"How do you know?"
he whispered into her hair.
"How do you know how to give them what they want? How to talk them down?"
She pressed her face into the privacy of his neck, breathing in the smell of him.
"How did you know to rub your hand like that up my back? How did you know how much I needed to feel that? To feel you close like this?"
She pressed her lips into his throat.
"You know because you care. And you care enough to take the chance of being wrong."
"Am I wrong? Do you want me to stop?"
She shifted her body, throwing a thigh across his hips.
"You can't be that bad at reading body language."
And so Cho had testified on her behalf to the selection committee. Their relationship had come under scrutiny during the psychological profiling sessions, and through it all, Meg had stood her ground. She refused repeatedly to rise to the bait of justifying her skills or bragging about her achievements. She knew, just as she had known when she and her team had cracked the internal deep space message, that if this mission involved putting human beings in an unprecedented situation, it would involve more than math. It would involve language and protocol. New situations almost invariably invoked fear in human beings, and the only remedy to fear was communication. Without language, without communication, all the numbers in the world would be useless. Without language, fear became deadly. Meg knew this all too well. It didn't surprise her in the least, therefore, that now that the mission had hit a critical snag, now that they were on the ground months, if not years, before they were prepared to make contact, it was Cho who stepped forward to stand beside her. She had already broken at least a dozen of her own rules of interaction, had contradicted the orders she had set in place, and yet she could feel Cho's confidence in her. She could sense the way he followed her lead, and she could see the way he checked her movements from the corner of his eye even as he bonded with the scientists in front of him. And with a crew as varied and hardened as that of the Damocles, the tacit approval of a hard-ass like Elliot Cho carried a lot of weight. That and the fact that without Meg, they would all be standing with their proverbial dicks in their hands, a fact she was more than prepared to point out if necessary. Lul.
The generals aren't going to let them stay out here forever.
The scientist beside him kept her eye on the aliens while she reached for a sample jar.
They're talking about moving them by force if necessary.
We can't do that.
Lul watched as Meg's fingers whipped around the light screen.
We don't know how they'll react. We've got to tell the generals that.
That's exactly what we've been doing.
The other scientist spoke up.
We're trying to convince them that maybe this terrain is unique for them, that they need this exact location to be able to breathe. We're saying it's the combination of the sand, limestone, and salt air.
Really?
Lul looked around. The uniqueness of the locale hadn't occurred to him.
Do you mean really that's what we're telling them, or really that's what we think?
Lul looked up at the two women, who were biting back smiles. The one closest to him laughed first.
We've got them mostly convinced that there's something unique about the Roana Temple. Some way their ship is interacting with the minerals that's either keeping them alive or keeping them calm. We're sort of playing both stories at the same time.
Do you believe that?
No.
The second woman lowered her voice, even though it would be impossible for anyone behind the barricade to hear them.
But if they believe it, they'll keep the soldiers back. For a while, at least. That gives us time to study them. If the military gets them back to the base, who knows what science team they'll bring in.
They'll bring you in, though, won't they?
The woman next to him looked at him with a shy smile.
You're a Lul Pell, aren't you? I've read your report 1,000 times. It's really brilliant work. I couldn't believe you weren't in the Science Academy. Especially now, I mean, look at them. Your anatomy predictions were really close.
Lul could only blink at the two wide-eyed scientists staring at him. According to the badges clipped to their overshirts, they were part of one of the highest-ranking science teams in Kartar, and they thought he was someone to be admired. Him, a mid-level weather watcher. Lul worried that maybe the unreality of this day would eventually melt his brain. The woman next to him bumped him with her shoulder.
I'm Effin. This is my work partner, Effin.
You're both named Effin?
Yeah.
Effin, too, shrugged.
You get used to it. It's really an honor to meet you, Mr. Pell. Do you think you could introduce us to...
She rocked on her heels in Meg's direction. The shock of being admired by the high-ranking scientists had momentarily eclipsed the presence of Meg and her companion, of the aliens and their ship and their strange and beautiful sounds and light screens and filmy shelters. He felt thankful he had gotten his drop in, but his rest had done little to wrap his mind around the situation. If anything, it all felt more surreal. But when he turned back to Meg, he knew she and her partner were discussing him. FN1 had told him his dropping out had agitated her for some reason. All that pride, all that sense of being special dimmed in light of the enormity of the gap between them and the aliens. Meg and her partner stopped talking for a moment when he looked at them, and then resumed their discussion. At least he thought they were speaking. He could see their thin throats working and their wide mouths moving, but any sounds they made disappeared on the Keter wind. Finally, they turned back to him and Meg's partner tapped his chest.
Cho.
His voice was deeper than Meg's and thus easier to hear, but Lul could still see the effort he took in projecting the sound. He tapped his chest again.
Cho.
Then he tapped Meg.
Meg.
Meg fiddled with the light screen, and the sound of a combined recording came from her speaker.
This is...
Cho. The scientists laughed and tapped knuckles. The one closest to him giggled.
Their voices sound like wind whistles.
What should we do?
The other effin looked from Lul to the aliens.
Do what he did.
Even as he said this, Lul knew the confusion that would arise. Effin was a very common name in Kartar. He had two cousins with the name, but he didn't know if names worked the same way with the Urfers. Effin, too, tapped her chest.
Effin.
Meg and her partner, Cho, showed their glassine teeth, tapping knuckles as they worked to make the sound. Cho got it first to a great round of knuckle bumping and a breathy bell-like sound from Meg.
Effin,
they said together, bumping their hands against the woman's. With a nod from Lul, Effin 1 tapped her chest.
Effin.
She smiled large when she spoke, but Lul saw Meg's already wide eyes widen farther. Her glance moved from Effin 2 to Effin 1 to Lul and back, and her head tilted in the way he recognized as meaning confusion. Her partner tilted his head toward her, his mouth moving with small tremors, only the faintest hint of sound escaping. Effin 2's smile faded.
What's wrong? Did I do something wrong?
Meg held up her hands, and like Lul, the Effins were helpless to look away from the long, flexible digits. She swept her hand over the women and tapped the screen. A recorded sound issued forth.
Yes, is this Effin?
She pointed to a symbol on the screen, a slender curl that looked like a hook.
Yes, is this Effin?
The recording repeated. Beside him, the women peppered him with worried questions.
Is there something wrong? Have we offended them? What's the matter?
He ignored them, instead watching Meg's eyes watching him, seeing again that longing to understand something he couldn't explain. As the women talked, Lul noticed small flashes of light appearing and disappearing around the edges of the screen. Meg's eyes occasionally flitted to them, seeming to make a note of them, but always returning to Lul. He had to stick with the basics. Moving his hand from one woman to the next, he said,
Effin. Effin.
Meg and her partner watched him, speaking to each other too quietly to be heard. She pointed to each of the women.
Effin. Effin.
Lul tapped his knuckles. She then pointed to the portable science lab opened between them.
Effin.
Yes, is this Effin?
Her long finger rested on the curved symbol on the screen. He could feel comprehension circling his mind, nipping and teasing but not showing itself. He thought he knew what she was asking. It was the same as when he'd told her his name and she'd waved her hands over the crowd behind him, wanting to know if Lul was a group name or his alone. Did the Urfers name themselves after the equipment they worked with? Maybe Meg was not just her name, but also a term to refer to the light panel she worked on. So then would the leader also be Meg? And what was the symbol she pointed to? He ground his teeth in frustration at the question in her eyes. This was impossible. Surely there was somebody behind the barricade with more experience in translating foreign languages than him. He checked himself. Not foreign. Alien. This wasn't some exchange student from Tan struggling to read off the menu. These were aliens, extraterrestrials, the very creatures he had incorrectly assumed he'd thrown his whole career away over. They were right in front of him. She was right in front of him, and she was looking to him for answers. He could do this. He had done this already. He was the only one so far the Urfers had spoken to in any sort of conversational way. Waving a hand toward the two women beside him, he spoke clearly.
Effin. Effin.
Then he pointed to the opened testing kit between them, debating on the simplest way to explain it.
Lab.
It seemed the shortest word to use. Meg and Cho communicated in that silent way of theirs, Meg's eyes occasionally flitting down to the screen, where lights and symbols continued to light up and disappear. The one symbol she had pointed to earlier remained illuminated. The little hook symbol pulled at him like a real hook, tugging at a recalcitrant corner of his mind that simply would not make the connection. He had no idea how this screen thing worked. For all he knew, it could launch codes for missiles or turn on the ship's engine. Hell, it could be tied in with the Urfer's life support systems. But since what he was doing now, nothing, was getting him exactly nowhere, Lul decided to take a chance. He pointed the tip of his blunt finger at the hooked symbol, slowly lowering his hand closer to the screen, giving Meg plenty of time to react if he was committing a no-no. She watched his hand, her eyes widening, and just as his finger broke the light plane, it occurred to Lul that this could be a really stupid idea. The light plane could burn him or cut the tip of his finger off or capture him. It could explode or shatter or send a jolt through his nervous system that would leave him paralyzed and drooling for the rest of his life. A million increasingly miserable possibilities raced through his mind as his finger slipped into the space of the little illuminated hook. But all that happened was a flashing red light and the faintest pinging sound. Meg watched him, leaning in closer, her head tipped to the side. She wondered what he was doing. So did he. He could barely follow his own wispy logic in this proceeding, so he figured he'd just let momentum carry him along. Meg had touched this symbol when he thought she'd asked if he was okay. Maybe this was some sort of permission symbol, an information symbol, a status checker of sorts. When she did nothing more than stare at him, expectation and confusion on her slender face, he amended his plan. Knowing he might just be adding to the confusion, he kept his finger on the symbol and said,
Cho.
Cho shifted at the word, nudging Meg, who flitted her fingers over the screen.
This is...
Cho, the recorded voices said. Lul put his finger through the symbol once more and pointed to the small silver box beside Cho.
Is that Cho?
His mind worked so hard trying to mentally bridge the gap between his stare and Meg's, he could feel heat radiating up from beneath his lower teeth. He heard the effins muttering about what the hell he was talking about, but he kept his eyes on Meg. He really hoped she could read minds, although at the moment all she would probably see in his was bewilderment and bedlam. Meg brought her hands up and let her knuckles fall away. She fiddled with the screen, ghosting her hands around Lul's unmoving finger, and the word issued forth. No. Lul pressed into the symbol space again.
What is this?
Meg smiled, once again leaning in even closer while her fingers flitted and his voice emanated from the gray patch on her shirt.
This is...
lab. The effins tittered in excitement, whispering about wanting to see the alien's small lab, already thinking about bridging their own gaps in extraterrestrial science. From the corner of his eye, he could see Cho peering into the larger lab kit across from him, but he knew, or at least he felt, that he and Meg wrestled with a different gap, a gap that felt like it was about to close. Meg's finger brushed against his at the hooked symbol. What is this? Her face hovered near enough that he could hear her breathy voice half a second before his own voice rumbled forth. She pointed to the effin's kit.
What is this?
Lab,
Lul answered. Lul settled back into his crouch, thoughts falling into place. He didn't even realize Meg mirrored him, settling back onto her heels, both of their eyes narrowing in thought, both waiting to see if they had reached the same conclusion. Lul wondered if maybe he was going a little crazy because it sure felt like he and Meg were communicating, not just through words and gestures, but really connecting. For the first time in his adult life, he felt no awkwardness at the possibility of making a mistake. Even though the fate of the planet might literally rest on him getting this conversation correct, all the pressure melted away in light of the improbability of the entire situation. What did he have to lose? He jabbed his finger at the symbol, then jabbed his finger where he had seen Meg press when the words yes and no had issued forth. Symbol yes. Symbol no. Symbol. No sounds emerged but the yes-no words. Meg rocked forward, her narrow shoulders hitching in that way he understood to mean she wanted him to repeat himself, so he did. Symbol yes. Symbol no. Symbol. A rash of heat burned beneath his jaw where he held his teeth tightly together, and he held his breath. Then all of Meg's teeth came into view. Her head tipped back at an impossible angle, and he could see the fine bones and tendons that made up her pale, slender neck, and he heard that staccato bell sound coming from her lips. Cho stared at her. The Effins stared at her. But Lul stared at her so hard he thought he might set her on fire with his mind until she bumped her knuckles together with enthusiasm. If that wasn't joy on her face, Lul didn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. He grinned along with her. She jabbed at the yes button again and again. Yes. 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 Without thinking, Lul rocked forward as she did, their hands bumping hard between them, this time not separating. They continued to lean in closer and closer, close enough that he could see the tender pink skin that held her fragile white teeth, could see small dark spots scattered over her narrow nose, and could see that her wide, wet eyes were fringed with fine black hair. He knew he grinned too as their foreheads touched and he smelled her strange warm breath. One of the Effins, or maybe both, demanded to know,
"What? What's happening? What did you do? What did you push?"
"I think..."
He lowered his voice so as not to shout into Meg's mouth.
"That the symbol is a question mark."
"It doesn't look like a question mark,"
Effin 2 said.
"It looks like a hook."
"Doesn't matter what it looks like."
Lul drifted back so his eyes could focus more clearly on Meg's smooth face.
"I think that's how we ask questions."
The Effins seemed unimpressed, but Lul continued to grin. A question mark. How appropriate. He knew he'd use that button a million times. Chapter 7 Lul. It really was no surprise that the media found out about the arrival. The arrival. That's what the Kartar Federal Administration called it when it finally held its press conference. The media webbing could only block out visuals for so long before the world became curious, especially at a popular tourist site like the Roana Temple. Normally, once the Zobos twins set, the Roana Temple drew hundreds of visitors a day, with the warmth of the red sun and the low-hanging Eliban sun making the temperature and light perfect for picnicking during high light and any manner of mystical conjuring and hard-partying during the low. What did surprise Lul was how ordinary this had all become, inasmuch as spending all of his shifts communicating with extraterrestrials could be. The invasion of the news helicopters and the scuffles and skirmishes going on behind the military barricades occurred in a distant world from his. For Lul, the rounds he had spent since being abducted from the telemetry building had become a lifetime unto themselves, a world inhabited by him, Meg, and some other people who came and went. Not that there hadn't been plenty of surprises to discover with the Urfers. Still most shocking was their pattern of falling into stasis every 4 or 5 shifts. The first time it had happened, that first bewildering day,